This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. No one writes better dialogue than Richard Price. Not Elmore Leonard, not David Mamet, not even David Chase. That's how New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani begins her review of Richard Price's new novel, Lush Life. I'll add that Price is not only a great writer, he's a great talker, and I always enjoy interviewing him. Price has written several books that have been adapted into movies, including The Wanderers, Clockers, and Freedomland. He wrote the screenplays for Sea of Love, Mad Dog and Glory, and The Color of Money. And he wrote several episodes of the HBO series The Wire. His new novel, Lush Life, is set on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where several different worlds collide. Would-be artists working in restaurants, kids in the projects selling drugs and carrying guns, new immigrants, and the cops who investigate the murder of one of those would-be artists. Richard Price, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to read from the beginning of the book. Would you just set it up for us briefly?
Okay. This is the beginning of the day of Eric Cash, who's one of the main characters, who is a kid. Well, he's not a kid. He's 35, but he's been living on the Lower East Side, working in a restaurant, holding on to this dream of being some kind of artist, and it's kind of slipping away. At 10 in the morning, Eric Cash, 35, stepped out of a Stanton Street walk-up, lit a cigarette, and headed off to work. When he had first moved down here 8 years ago, he was seized with the notion of the Lower East Side as haunted, and on rare days like today, a simple walk like this could still bring back his fascination, traces of the 19th-century Yiddish boomtown everywhere, in the claustrophobic gauge of the canyon-like streets with their hanging garden of ancient fire escapes, in the eroded stone satyr heads leering down between pitted window frames above the erotic boutique, in the faded Hebrew lettering above the old socialist cafeteria turned Asian massage parlor turned kitty club hotspot, all of it and more lying along Eric's daily four-block commute. But after nearly a decade in the neighborhood, even on a sun-splashed October morning like this, all of this ethno-historical mix-and-match was, much like himself, getting old. He was an upstate Jew, five generations removed from here, but he knew where he was. He got the joke, the Laboratorio di Gelato, the Tibetan Hat Boutique, 88 Forsyth House with its historically restored cold water flats, not all that much different from the unrestored tenements that surrounded it. And in his capacity as manager of Cafe Berkman, the flagship of Come On Down, on the rare days when the Beast would take one of its cat naps, he enjoyed being part of the punchline. But what really drew him to the area wasn't its full-circle irony, but its nowness, its right-here-and-nowness, which spoke to the true engine of his being, a craving for making it made many times worse by a complete ignorance as to how this it would manifest itself. He had no particular talent or skill, or what was worse, he had a little talent, some skill, playing the lead in a basement theater production of The Dybbuk, sponsored by 88 Forsyth House 2 years ago, his third small role since college, having a short story published in a now-defunct Alphabet City literary rag last year, his fourth in a decade, neither accomplishment leading to anything. And this unsatisfied yearning for validation was starting to make it near impossible for him to sit through a movie or read a book or even case out a new restaurant, all pulled off increasingly by those his age or younger, without wanting to run face first into a wall.
That's Richard Price reading from his new novel, Lush Life. The story brings together characters in the same neighborhood but who are from different worlds. Would you describe the collisions of reality that you've set up here?
Well, the Lower East Side, I went down there. I've always been haunted by the Lower East Side. But in my mind, there was the historical Jewish immigrant Lower East Side and this new sort of hipperati, Eden for, kids in their 20s, the sort of laptoppers with the sort of the same amount of hair on the top of their head as on their chin. But I didn't know what I was getting into. It's like Byzantium. I mean, I found out, there's the immortal world of the housing projects on the East River. There's the world of the Orthodox Jews. There's this very huge and hidden world of the Fujian Chinese that are living there as sort of half undocumented, overcrowded. They're living there like Jacob Riis-era Jews. And you got all five worlds. You've got the, I don't know, you call them yuppies anymore, but, you got the ghetto kids, the Chinese, the Orthodox, the privileged kids. And they're all walking around sort of oblivious to each other. And it's like they see – they don't see each other until it's about 4 in the morning and some kids from the projects decide to mug, you know, two kids from the Midwest who are bar hopping. And everybody says the wrong thing. A shot goes off and you have headlines for 5 days.
Oh, what's the wrong thing that the guy who gets shot says?
Well, in my book, what the guy says when he has a gun in his face is, "Not tonight, my man." I mean, he thinks he's in a movie.
Yes, exactly. And you call it death by suicide because he says something that's like really stupid and he gets shot. But, you know, for somebody who's written those movies and who knows the difference between life and a movie, I find it really interesting that you've put those kind of movie words in his mouth. And instead of making him a hero, it makes him dead.
Well, what happens is that you got a lot of people down there now. Like I say, they kind of live in their own world and they're kind of blind to these other worlds that they're around. And this goes both ways because the kids in the projects really don't understand, you know, this wave of MFAs that are living down there. And, you know, you go bar hopping, you get all beard up. It's 3 in the morning. Somebody puts a gun in your face. You never had a gun in your face before in Indiana or wherever you come from. And you think you're John Wayne and you say the worst possible thing you can say, but all of a sudden, you know, the movie's over.
Now, why is that? Why is "Not tonight, my man" the worst thing that you could say to a kid from the projects who has a gun on you?
Well, you're forcing. Well, what happens is somebody who puts a gun in your face like that, I mean, if they have an audience behind them, you know, it's like you're challenging their manhood. You know, it's would you rather go to jail for the rest of your life or are you going to look like a punk in front of your friends? You know, and 99% of the time when a crime like that happens, it's unintentional or it wasn't, I'm going to go out and shoot somebody. It's like, I'm going to go out, scare somebody with this gun and get enough money to buy some Chinese takeout.
Well, you know, it's not just like the kids from the projects and these, you know, would-be actors and screenwriters working at restaurants who don't understand each other. The cops, when they arrive on the scene, don't really get the, you know, would-be screenwriter who has survived. It's his friend who's been killed. So the guy who survived is being questioned, and they don't get each other either. What don't they understand each other about each other, the cops and this would-be screenwriter?
Well, the cops are a sixth world down there, down in the Lower East Byzantium, in which that these are out-of-borough guys. And basically they deal with the worst – they deal with the stuff down there and the people down there who need to be policed. And more often than not, the victims are either Chinese because they're seen as police phobic. They never go to the cops, so they're easy marks. And the Chinese are terrified of cops. So they either deal with the Chinese who don't want to deal with them, or, you know, they deal with these kids who just got mugged. And oftentimes the kids are getting mugged, look at the cops as sort of not exactly as servants or lower class, but, you know, they see them as there to serve them. You know, it's not like you're going to a police officer, you know, because, you know, you grew up in an area where, you know, where cops were important or something. It's like there's this guy now who's interrogating me. And, you know, this guy has nowhere near the education I have, you know, nowhere near the smarts I have. And, you know, the cop winds up feeling like a domestic.
And then the cops misinterpret things about this, you know, educated would-be screenwriter who works at a restaurant.
Well, what happens is, you know, the kid is so shattered by what happened to his friend. I mean, he just sort of faced death. And he's doubly shattered by his reaction to it, which is basically to run away. And, you know, he's mortified. And the cops are picking up the signal that this kid is lying. And to a cop, a lie is just this side of an admission of guilt. And what they do is they see it as a wound. And they just – and for 8 hours with this kid, they just push at that wound, push at it, you know, open it wider and wider. So whatever shred of self the kid had at the end of that traumatic experience of the shooting, the cops eviscerated in the next 8 hours in the interrogation room thinking he did it and just going after him and just trying to reduce him to a puddle. but in fact, you know, the kid didn't do it. And the thing is, in that world of the Lower East Side, you know, with these young white kids, it's I say like 30 is the new 50. I mean, there's such a pressure to shine and to be something special, either some kind of maverick entrepreneur or a great artiste, that the character is 35 now, which is really old. And just like every other person in the restaurant industry, he's a hyphen, you know, a bartender slash performance artist or maitre d' slash actor or a manager slash novelist. And this is when you're 22 or 23. Now you're 35, and all of a sudden that hyphen starts fading. And what used to be a bartender slash actor is now just the bartender. And everybody around him is 10 years younger, still has dew in the eyes, and he's just hanging on by his fingernails. And this incident and the way the cops top off the trauma of the shooting just guts him.
You know, your novel isn't exactly a celebration of multiculturalism. It's more like the Tower of Babel.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, bearing witness. It's not like look at all the pretty flowers in the garden, that's for sure.
Richard, I'm going to ask you to read another short passage from Lush Life. And this is the passage about a couple of kids in the project. I'm going to ask you to introduce the passage for us.
Okay. Well, the two kids, one boy's name is Tristan. The other kid's name is Little Dap. And they're getting stoned on the roof of a building that they live in the housing projects. And Little Dap is warming Tristan up to, you know, let's go into the main part of the Lower East Side in the middle of the night. And we'll jack a couple of kids. Couple of white kids that are bar hopping, and it'll be an easy way to get money so then we can go up to Washington Heights, score a bunch of dope, come down, sell it back to the very white kids that we just mugged, more or less. So this is the conversation between Tristan and Little Dap. "So what do you say, passing Tristan the roach? You going to be my Dolja out there or what? I need to hear you say it." Tristan took a last hit. "Yeah, okay." The words coming out like smoke signals. "All right, then." Little Dap offering his fist for a pound. Tristan fighting off another out-of-control smile. It felt so good. Something did at any rate. "Man, you are one grinny son of a gun," Little Dap said, popping the nub of the joint in his mouth, taking a gun out of his sweatshirt muff and attempting to hand it over. Tristan reared back and laughed, if you could call it that. "What?" Little Dap blinked. "Nah." "Nah? What, you think you go out there and what? Yell at somebody?" He took Tristan by the wrist. "It ain't like you use it, man," slapping it into his palm. "You just flash it." At first, Tristan tried to pass it back to him, but then got caught up with the feel of it in his hand, the giddy heft. "Nah, man, this'll be good for you," Little Dap said. "Get you blooded, you know what I'm saying? First time's like first time sex. You just do it to get it done with. Then you can start concentrating on getting better at it, having fun with it." "All right." Tristan staring and staring at the thing in his hand. "Can I ask you something?" Little Dap waited. And waited. "What is a dolja?" "A dolja?" Tristan said. "A do-anything soldier." "Okay. Okay? Okay," Tristan grinning. "You in the game now, son." Little Dap studied him, studying the gun. "Time to show and prove."
That's Richard Price reading from his new novel, Lush Life. In the course of your writing, Clockers, The Wire, this book, you have kids kind of entering the life, often reluctantly, but they get into it in part because it's like the world around them. So I guess, I'm not sure what my question is, but do you feel like you've witnessed that a lot too?
I grew up in a projects, and it was a different time in a different place. I mean, it was a more functional world. But I spent a lot of time in the 80s and, you know, teaching in the rehab centers in the Bronx and just being around the old places where I grew up and to see how they changed. And I think, you know, what you're dealing with is two things. You're dealing with kids who have no sense of a future, act on spur of the moment, and never think of consequences. And, you know, they just It's like you're in a jungle. You don't think about the clearing and a mile away. You just want to get the blades of grass directly in front of you out of the way. So you just move. You know, and it's like act first, think later.
What about the language that the kids use, like the street language that you use, the drug language that you're using now, compared to, say, in Clockers?
Well, the thing is, like, in terms of the argot, I feel like Margaret Mead with a pith helmet on when I talk about this stuff. But, basically, I don't try to capture anybody's glossary. I pretty much make it all up. The fact of the matter is, language it morphs so quickly that if you were to try to this kid just used this phrase I never heard before. By the time that phrase hits a bookstore, it's like Run DMC. You know, it's a losing proposition. So you might as well make up your own stuff. Nobody's going to know the difference.
And do you ever start actually using those words yourself, realizing that they'd be really out of context?
If you use them, you kind of use them ironically. Or you use them to curry favor with your kids just so they don't think, you're pathetic. Did you see the clothes I have to wear?
Yes.
No, blue Timberland boots, You have to wear that cap with the bill over the ear.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned the cap. This is a line I assume you wrote because it was from one of the episodes of The Wire that you wrote. One of the cops is ribbing one of the kids in the neighborhood, one of the corner boys. This is one of the kids who's not particularly bright. And the kid has the brim of his hat angled to the side. And the cop says to him, "Where do you get those hats? I've only seen the ones where the brim's in front."
And the kid looks at him straight ahead and says, no, they're all like that. And the cop just realized the joke fell flat and he feels bad. The kid's half retarded. And they just, okay, never mind.
Did you write that?
Yeah. But you know what? I had that in Clockers because David Simon told me that The Wire was sort of inspired by Clockers. And every time it was my turn to write, he says, "Do that scene in Clockers again." So, I was basically, plagiarizing my own stuff on The Wire from Clockers.
Did it make you uncomfortable to do that?
No, I didn't really care. It was the biggest compliment in the world that The Wire is so amazing that the Clockers, had a part in getting it going. It was very flattering. And, hey, I eat cannibals. What can I say? It was fine.
So were you surprised when David Simon told you that The Wire is based on your novel?
Not really. I was flattered and, I was all for it. And I think what he did in The Wire was to take the world of Clockers, to much higher, into the infrastructure of the country. Clockers was about trench warfare. It was about cops and the kids. But he went right up to the city hall. He went right up to the state assembly of Maryland. He just kept going up and up and up. And, he just brought the entire world into that in such a nuanced and complex way that, in fact, I was a little bit intimidated when he asked me to come on as a writer because I thought he assumed that I knew an awful lot more about the world than I really did. I put everything I had into Clockers.
So it must have been interesting when you were asked to write for a series that was already underway, knowing that your novel Clockers had helped inspire the series, and yet you came in as a newcomer to the series and had to pick up on the language of the series, the style of the series and everything. So what were some of the things that you were told before you actually got started writing?
That I shouldn't be worried. Just do it. The way it works on The Wire is that you sit down for a 3-day story meeting because it's so complex and there were 6 character trajectories per episode, and there were 12 episodes. And so you had to sit down, and your episode, very specific things have to happen to these 6. This is what goes down in City Hall. This is what goes down with Omar, the shooter. This is what goes down with the drug crews. This is what goes down with the police department. And you leave after 2 days with a stack of index cards, which are all your scenes, because what you do in episode 3 has to perfectly match up with episodes 1 and 2 and perfectly set up episode 4. So you're a little bit like you're writing in a phone booth, that your only opportunity to make your mark on it is, what kind of spins and what kind of humor and style you can put on the scenes that you're obliged to write.
But that's a kind of interesting discipline, isn't it?
I liked it because it involved having a real social life. Writing is so isolating. I mean, basically, you sit there for 30 years rearranging 26 letters of the alphabet by yourself. You get cobwebs going from your forehead to the pen. Phone never rings. Now all of a sudden you got you got six other idiots there, and you're actually doing this thing called having a conversation. It's revolutionary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. Several of his novels were adapted into films, including The Wanderers, Freedomland, and Clockers. Clockers, which was about kids who sell drugs on inner-city street corners and the cops who work those streets, helped inspire David Simon to create the HBO series The Wire. At Simon's invitation, Price wrote several episodes of The Wire. The series finale is this Sunday. You wrote what may be my favorite episode, though it's really hard to choose from so many great ones. But this is an episode, it's like episode 3 of season 4. And this is an episode in which a former cop named Przybylowski, after kind of mistakenly, accidentally shooting another cop, leaves the force and decides to become a teacher at a middle school in the same neighborhood that his precinct is in. So these are the same kids who've been on the corner where he's worked. So this is like his first day in school as a teacher. The kids have just gotten into his first homeroom class of the semester, and he's trying to settle them down and introduce himself. His name is Przybylowski. I just want to play this really short clip.
Okay, good morning. Okay, good morning.
Yo, shut up!
Good morning. I'm your homeroom teacher, obviously. My name is Mr. Przybylowski. But you can call me Mr. Przybylowski. Okay, let's find out who you are.
Richard Price, what I love about that scene is that that joke falls with such a thud. And it's in part because it's kind of lame, but also it's because the kids just don't get it. I mean, like, his sense of humor is not on their wavelength at all. And I was wondering if you experienced that kind of thing when you were teaching, like, at rehab centers in the Bronx, that there was a certain kind of irony that you traded in that just was not going to make it with them, wasn't going to resonate with them.
Well, what happened, and I personally, didn't experience that because I was so charismatic personally. Just the kids were just stunned by my presence. What happens is that when they see somebody that's an authority figure, and that authority figure tries to curry favor with them or be warm to them, oftentimes that's misinterpreted as a sign of weakness, because you're used to authority figures being oppressive. And your whole point is, how do I survive this person? And when the person comes at you with their own throat bared, it's like, okay, I'm the top wolf. I get it. And the teacher who's trying with lame jokes is not getting the subtext there. That they're looking at this guy saying, how much trouble is this guy going to be in my life?
I taught ever so briefly and in junior high, and I realized pretty quickly that my idea of funny, self-deprecating humor was going to get me into so much trouble. It was going to be seen as a sign of lacking in self-respect. Like, if you said anything that mocked yourself, it meant you didn't respect yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, there's no – because there's very little wiggle room for self-confidence, in like the poorer, rougher areas. It's not a soft world, and self-deprecation is not – is not a common currency. And when somebody puts themselves down, there's no sense of irony. It's taken at face value oftentimes, especially with the younger kids.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Price, and his new novel is called Lush Life. He is also known for his novel Clockers. He's one of the writers for The Wire and has written many other novels. You've spoken to a lot of cops over the years as research for your books, for your screenplays, A Sea of Love. And, you know, when you started talking to cops, they probably didn't know who you were from a hole in the wall. But now, if you talk to cops, whether it's for research or any other reason, they're probably going to know Clockers. They're probably going to know The Wire. And, I mean, they're going to know your work. And you might be, like, a real hero to them in that respect. So has it changed the relationship that you have with cops now?
No, I just want to say this one thing about myself and cops. I mean, I'm not, like, into cops. You know, it's like I'm not a buff. I'm not, you know, my politics are certainly not Law and Order. I'll hang out with anybody who'll have me. What I find when I'm with cops is you just see the world in a way that you would never see on your own. You can walk around the Lower East Side. You see what you see. You see what makes it into Time Out magazine. You see this and that. And then you go around in the back of a police car and you deal with people whose behavior is in such extremis that a police presence is required. And you're there. And the difference is like staring at the ocean from above the water and putting on a snorkel mask and ducking your head and seeing coral for the first time. You have no idea what's down there until you put that mask on. And what I saw of that world with the police, and it was something I never would have seen. I never would have had that snorkel mask.
So you did travel with the police through the Lower East Side before writing the book?
Oh, I went with the cops, but I also hung out at these sort of like nouveau restaurants down there, you know, the come on down, it's safe restaurants. Hung out in the projects. I went to some synagogues down there that are so old and on their last legs that, I mean, there was one tiny synagogue I went to down there that their last circumcision was 65 years ago.
Wow.
But because of this new wave of kids, the irony is that a lot of, and the thing that got me writing Lush Life was the fact that when I brought my kids down here, you know, they were relatively young. And all of a sudden I realized I'm buying them a gelati. And 100 yards from where I bought them that gelati, their great-grandfather was fighting for his life in 1915. And probably could have lived for a month on what the gelati cost. You know, and then when they got a little older and a little more independently mobile on their own when they hit their teens, you know, all of a sudden they know the Lower East Side better than I do. But what they know is, where, you know, what bars to go to where you won't get carded. The most adorable hole-in-the-wall boutiques. They know the knitting factory, all the music, well, the best music down there and where the best arts is. But they were kind of not really aware that they are making a five-generation full circle. And this is exactly where their family started out. And that's one of the things that made me crazy about wanting to write this, is I just wanted to make that five-generation circle visible.
Did your grandparents ever tell you stories about the Lower East Side
of
the days they lived there?
Oh, absolutely.
What are some things they told you?
Well, I remember my grandmother told me that the way she learned about sex is in the summer, nobody could sleep in their apartments because they were all ovens. So everybody wound up sleeping on the roof. And you have entire families, you have an entire tenement building sleeping on the roof. And, you know, people are going to have sex up there. And she says that's how she learned about sex, because it was too hot to sleep in your apartment. You know, and just people acted as if they were in their bedrooms. My grandfather, you know, had been locked up for a number of times, for violent crimes. It was a violent, nasty place. The whole point of the Lower East Side, and I think the whole point still, except for this new, you know, this new wave going in there, the whole point of the Chinese being, the whole point of getting in there is to start so you can, just to get out of there. But the dichotomy of this place, everybody thinks it's done. Like between Giuliani time, you know, like really aggressive policing and real estate needing a place to go. Real estate is the greatest crime fighter in the world. You know, we need this place, you know. And here come the cops, and the place that used to be a heroin apartment is now going for $1 million. People know there, where, you know, of the Jacob Riis era, low, it was had the highest population density in the world in 1900. And not India, not China, but the Lower East Side. I mean, you had more people per square inch living down there. But I remember going with police, and there had been a Chinese suicide, and they had to follow up on it. And they go to two buildings on Orchard Street, and these buildings were obviously built by the same contractor in about 1880. They had identical facades, except one building had been rehabbed and one building hadn't. And the one that – and they went into the wrong building, and they wound up pushing all the buzzers, and they get in, and somebody's got a floor-through apartment. It's, you know, two young people, and, you know, it's a nice loft. They say, whoops, wrong building. They ring the buzzers. The other building, the door is not locked. There's gaffer's tape on the lock because too many people have to come and go and not enough keys. They go up to an apartment where you have like 30 Chinese guys are living there. And the apartment, you know, hasn't been touched since the 1970s. Actually, it has. But particle board has been put up. Shelves have been put on the wall like library shelves, except they're beds. They're just planks. Mm. And these buildings have identical facades, and they're by cheek and jowl with each other. And the guy who lived there committed suicide. And what they found out was, you know, the guy had been living on 10% of what he'd been earning, sending everything back either to the snakehead that got him smuggled into the country or to his family back in the Fujian province. And, you know, you got to live on a dime. And if you develop a gambling habit, you're dead. If you get sick, you're dead. And you know, a guy killed himself. Something went amiss, and he couldn't maintain that survival margin. You know, but he's living next to, One Tree Hill.
There's another paragraph I want you to read from your new novel, Lush Life. And for people just tuning in, this is about several groups of people on the Lower East Side. There's two guys, one older, one younger, who work at a restaurant, both with aspirations to either, you know, write screenplays or be an actor. One of them is killed, mugged by a couple of kids from the project. And this is a paragraph from the point of view of the father of the boy who's killed. Would you read it for us and set it up in any other way you want to?
Okay, well, I mean, this is a father who ironically lives in Riverdale and is one of these people that are like four generations out of the Lower East Side, and his son, who just got an MFA from Columbia, is now back obliviously in this playground of this Montparnasse playground of Ludlow Street, and he's the kid that gets shot because he doesn't know how to respond appropriately to a gun in his face. And so now his father is down there, and, you know, every thought, I mean, I use the expression, you know, if a child is murdered or somebody's murdered, I mean, you become tortured. Everything you think of, it's like your mind becomes like this vicious warehouse. And he's just making a statement to the cop. I mean, the cop has to be basically a sympathetic listener. This guy is no help whatsoever to him. He's insane with grief. But this is just, you know, one of the things he thinks about with his dead son. "You know," Billy said, addressing the middle distance, "when they're little, you love them, take pride in them. And when they grow up, you still do. But it's bizarre when other people, new people, see him and think, well, here's this young man, here's this young adult who does such and such very well. And you're witnessing this acceptance from others, this respect and seriousness. And you, I can't help laughing, thinking, that's what young man? That's Ikey. You wouldn't believe the dopey crap he did as a kid. But there he is getting respect. And it's not like I don't have it for him, me of all people. But I always feel like laughing, not put him in his place laughing, just, oh, come on, that's Ike."
I love that paragraph. And I figure that must really describe how so many parents feel when their kids reach their teens and start to become adults, and the parents still sees them as a kid and the world sees them as a young adult.
You know, which is fine. I mean, you can screw up every step of the way, and then you can still evolve into a better relationship with them, but all of a sudden their life is cut short, and all you can think of is the, you know, you can never fix this like you probably naturally would. You never would have thought of this as being contemptuous of your own child, but you're afraid the dead child would think that you were contemptuous or you weren't giving him enough credit. I mean, it's a no issue unless there's no way to, you know, rectify the situation by just the relationship having years and years to evolve.
Was this a hard place to put yourself in, you know, as the father of two teenage girls?
Oh, boy. I mean, you know, the last two books, I think, you know, the biggest thing in my life, you know, between Samaritan and this book was, you know, the experience of having children. You know, I mean, that was the headline news of my life for the last 20 years. There are huge parts of this book that didn't make it into the final cut because there was too much stuff like what I just read. Because I so got into the father's, this grief-stricken babalogue. And my editor convinced me, and rightly so, that a little bit goes a long way. We got it. You know, that's the big thing he had to say to me, is that we got the father so quickly that, you know, the rest of the stuff is not necessary. It's just we're not moving forward. So a lot of that, you know, hit the wayside.
One of the episodes that you end The Wire with involves children, and Kima, who's one of the detectives on The Wire, she's a woman who's a lesbian, and she and her partner have split up. Like once her partner has a baby, her partner's life really changes, and Kima just doesn't feel comfortable in that kind of domestic life. So she's kind of basically left, but she wants to reconnect with her son, and so she's basically babysitting her son one night, and her son can't sleep. And so the episode ends with Kima taking her little boy who can't sleep to the window, and she looks down at the dark street with the boy and plays this little game with him of saying goodnight to everybody. Let me just play that.
Good night, moon.
Good night,
moon. Here we go. Good night, stars.
Good night, stars.
Good night, popos.
Good night, popos.
Good night, fiends.
Good night, fiends.
Good night, hoppers.
Good night, hoppers.
Good night, hustlers.
Good night, hustlers.
Good night, scammers.
Good night, scammers.
Good night. To everybody.
Good night to everybody.
Good night to one and all.
Good night to one and all.
Richard Price, when I saw that scene, I kept thinking, God, I bet you play that with your girls. I bet you looked out the window and said good night to everybody.
Well, not only did I say, you know, good night, moon, good night, crackheads,
with
my kids, good night, werewolves, good night, muggers, good night, yuppies. Not only did I do that, but that scene in The Wire was a word-for-word ripoff of Clockers. David said, do that thing you did in Clockers where Rocco takes his kid to the window and say good night, moon. So, I mean, I love doing it. I mean, it was A-okay with me. I mean, it just gives my book a second life. But, I mean, that's what David would do. So do that thing. Do that thing when the cop comes out of the movie theater and he's surrounded by all the kids that are in the other movie theaters who went to see the horror movies. And he thinks that they're going to jump him. And all of a sudden, they're just delighted to see him. It's like seeing your teacher at a urinal or something. Oh, my God, you're human. David kept saying to me, put that thing in from Clockers. And that was one of them. But, you know, I thought it was very sweet summing up, you know.
So when she says good night, scammers, good night, hustlers, you'd say good night, crackheads.
Yeah, I had to update the good nights from Clockers in 1992 to The Wire in 2007, but I had to put in hoppers, which is the word for young drug dealers, I think. But there were a couple of updated good nights in there, but it was basically the same scene.
You had told me before that you just started using a computer. Like in the past year or two, has it changed your writing?
Well, yes and no. My handwriting's neater on a computer. That's good. But it's too easy to fool around and like, so I'm going to put this stuff here. It's too easy to fiddle. And you're under the illusion you're working when basically you're vamping because you can, do all this stuff. I think I'm going to do this in, Swedish Helvetica. Maybe this would look good in Diablo, whatever the hell that is. And so you spend like 2 hours and you haven't done anything on a book. Before this, I was always handwriting on a legal pad. And you couldn't fool around when you're doing handwriting. Like, go back and change this and that. It was just too labor intensive. And it sort of forced you to go forward. You know, and the other thing about handwriting, it's as close as I'll ever be to being a visual artist. I mean, you know, these pages after, you know, the crossouts and the whiteouts look like Cy Twombly wrote it.
You know? Richard Price, it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Oh, you're welcome.
Richard Price's new novel is called Lush Life. He's written for the HBO series The Wire, which concludes Sunday. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the series creator, David Simon. A.J. Liebling was one of the giants of mid-20th century American journalism. As a writer for The New Yorker magazine, he explored whatever subjects took his comic fancy. But when World War II began in Europe, Liebling found his most profound subject. Liebling was sent over to France in 1939 as The New Yorker's war correspondent and eventually found himself covering D-Day. The Library of America has just brought out a collection of A.J. Liebling's World War II pieces, and book critic Maureen Cargan says it should be a must-read for anyone who cares about good writing.
It would be easy to dismiss the Library of America's new collection of World War II stories by legendary journalist A.J. Liebling as just a quick-buck nostalgia project. Certainly there's plenty in this volume to feel nostalgic about. Liebling began writing for The New Yorker in the mid-1930s, during its golden age. He started covering the war for the magazine in 1939 after, as he recalls, putting in several man-hours of barroom time, impressing the managing editor with my profound knowledge of France. The pieces he began filing are filled with details straight out of Casablanca and the spy novels of Alan First. Liebling flew over to Europe on a Pan Am clipper. In an anxious Paris, he took note that an edition of The Predictions of Nostradamus was a bestseller, and that a department store was advertising women's fashions with a slogan that read, "Madame, it is your duty to be elegant." As the Germans approached, he hightailed it to Portugal by car, foot, and sleeper train, where he found himself in the company of a motley crew of European exiles, including a smooth German in a wine bar, who, upon noting that Liebling was American, insisted that, "My dear sir, Hitler has absolutely no designs on Canada or the United States. He is a fair man who wants only his rights." Liebling dryly commented that the stranger's assurances recalled what the Germans had said before each of their gobbles. If you got a kick a split second ago out of Liebling's use of the word gobbles, then you already have a sense of why this collection is more than just a sentimental journey through the good war. Liebling is one of those magical writers whose style you could dissect for days and still never quite grasp. To have Liebling's voice describing an early morning in England during the Blitz, with the sun rising the color of lard, or the anxious tedium of a long ocean crossing on a Norwegian tanker during the Battle of the Atlantic, is really to experience the perfect match of a writer at the top of his game and a subject commensurate with his ability to wonder. The Library of America volume of Liebling runs over 1,000 pages and consists of 3 books and 26 previously uncollected pieces. Most of the writing here was originally published in The New Yorker and is about World War II, although Normandy Revisited, which was originally published in 1958, deals with memories of the war as well as the sad practical necessity of forgetting some aspects of it. I said that Liebling's power as a writer is hard to completely capture, but certainly one of his great gifts was a gimlet eye for detail. On the eve of D-Day, Liebling describes a chaplain leading a prayer service on the landing craft he was aboard. Afterwards, the men were given printed copies of General Eisenhower's message to the Allied Expeditionary Force. Liebling reports that, "Members of our ship's crew went about getting autographs of their shipmates on their Eisenhowers, which they apparently intended to keep as souvenirs of the invasion." One of his best-known war pieces, called Molly, is about coming upon a dead American soldier in Tunisia in 1943. The other soldiers respectfully refer to him as Comrade Molotov, or Molly, and tell Liebling he once captured 600 Italian soldiers single-handedly. Liebling becomes fascinated with Molly, whose civilian name was Carl Warner. He tracks down Molly's sister in a tenement apartment in New York City, and he discovers that, far from being the swaggering mayor of Broadway, as he pretended to be to his fellow privates, Molly, before the war, was a dishwasher in a dumpy bar in Greenwich Village. Liebling says Molly became a sort of posthumous pal, and he goes on to say, "It cheers me to think there may be more like him all around me, a notion I would have dismissed as sheer romanticism before World War II. Cynicism is often the shamefaced product of inexperience." There's so much more to celebrate in this collection, including the fact that it was edited by Pete Hamill, one of Liebling's inheritors. But I'm sure Hamill would agree that when the journalism gods made Liebling, they pretty much broke the mold. And to any skeptics out there who think I'm being unduly worshipful or sentimental, Liebling's wise words bear repeating. Cynicism is often the shamefaced product of inexperience.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed World War II writings by A.J. Liebling.